Hello, my friends. This week, I have a very special episode just for you. Last week, I got to attend the Culture Impact Lab in Chicago. This is a delightful little conference I highly recommend. And surprise, surprise, my longtime friend and co-conspiring organizational rebel friend, Josh Levine, was there. He and I met almost exactly 10 years ago, and neither of us had any clue the other was going to be at this thing. A delightful moment of serendipity. Now, Josh is also a podcast host. He actually has two, one called Great Mondays and one called The Job Shit Show. I highly recommend them both. And he had the idea that we should do an interview while we were there together. So we cover a wide range of topics in this conversation. Here's the top three I think you're going to really enjoy. One, how one economist's paper from the 1970s broke work. Two, why we gotta stop trying to out-robot the robot. And three, yes, we are in a moment of job crisis, but this moment is not unprecedented. Huge thanks to my friend and colleague for his beautiful and important work in the world. And without further ado, please enjoy this conversation between me and the amazing Josh Levine.
Hey, everybody. We are doing a live conversation here. I'm Josh Levine.
I'm Josh Allen Dykstra.
And we have both been talking about organizations, change, and how to make work better for people for a long time. And we happen to be at the same conference at the same time. And so we're taking the opportunity to have a live conversation about the state of play within organizations. And I'm thinking about it like we are in the moment. And if you are in an enterprise organization or any business, it kind of feels like a crisis. So it's almost like the organizational crisis moment. Josh and I were talking last night during our happy hour, our first evening here, about what does it mean to be in this crisis and how we might get out of it. Josh, one of the things that I thought was really interesting was that one of the speakers brought up the article that popped up in the 1970s about the mandate. It's like the only job of business, the social good of business, is to make a profit.
Yes, Milton Friedman.
Milton Friedman, right? So this was kind of the start of the, I don't know, modern philosophy of business. I always saw that as that kind of kickoff moment where, and then the speaker hypothesized that after that, everybody just sort of ran in that direction of maximizing profit at all expenses. What are your, do you have like a observation about that in your 20 years around companies doing that kind of thing? Is that, do you agree with my hypothesis that that's really where we started to see, let's say, started this crisis, just to stick with this kind of anchoring point?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, to me, it does seem like a inflection point, at least, to where a lot of people did jump on, a lot of leaders kind of jumped on that bandwagon, I think, in the 70s. And then into the 80s, we got the, you know, greed is good kind of decade of 80s, right. And then the 90s, right? Like, so I do think there's a, it became a bit of a flashpoint that leaders adopted that mindset of that paper that Friedman put out then. And the inevitable road of that thinking, right, kind of then got married, I think, with the ideology of neoliberalism as well. Mm-hmm. Right. So this kind of like privatize everything.
Business will solve the world's problems.
Yep. And then arrived at a moment in the 70s when the system was really being questioned. And so we were starting to get a lot of the instability of the 70s, right? This kind of cultural revolution of the 70s. And then we got kind of the economic shock of the late 70s around the stagflation and the oil crisis that happened then. And so this ideology arrived at a really convenient time and I think made a lot of sense at that moment in history. It was like, we need to do something different. Like
It was clarifying, right? You don't even need to read the article. You just know what it's about, right? Like powerful idea.
An idea that made sense, I think, in the context of, a system coming out of World War II that wasn't making sense anymore.
That's right.
And so now it was like, okay, we need to do something different. And this kind of arrived and was like, yeah, maybe the private market can do this better than government.
Than government.
Yeah. And so I think it arrived at a moment when it felt like it was helpful. And I just think what we've seen now is 40 to 50 years of that thinking has led us to a place that actually turns out, isn't all that helpful, right? Like, it's just exacerbated the inequality of things to the point inside organizations and out, where we've got just, it's created another Gilded Age, really. And it's not
a fair comparison.
It's not sustainable.
Well, so one of the points or one of the threads that I want to connect is the drivers of, or the way that organizations attempted to achieve or put into place that philosophy. So we are talking about the drive, and this is reflected in culture as well, which is this drive for the ultimate idea is efficiency. That is the virtue. Mm-hmm. That is the business virtue, is efficiency and maximizing productivity and putting that responsibility on the individuals within the organization. I will add this sort of classic American idea of the individual as the hero. And what that has caused is the kind of absorption of that idea where I can just sit here for another hour and get more done. And even if I'm not being paid for it, we've been able to deliver on that increased efficiency through technological advances. And we have that. We're like, okay, great. We're implementing our CRMs and our ERPs. And now we don't even have to go on to emails. We can do Slack. We can message. We can communicate. Oh, we can actually do work at all hours of the day. And the system that started being created then is rewarding that behavior.
Mm-hmm.
How do we become more busy as a symbol of the output? And that, I think, is what brings us to today's moment.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't see it, but I'm using my hands to describe it's almost like a funnel. And we started very wide, and there is this, I don't even know what it is the funnel is made of, but there's all these pressures. It's what the funnel is being formed by, all these pressures to do more, to add more priorities, to add more features, to add more hours, to do more things. And that becomes this background for the crisis that I think we're entering into.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a continual kind of nonstop pressure to efficientize everything.
Yeah.
Like to mm-hmm. productivize everything.
Yeah.
Make things faster, cheaper. It's a race to the bottom in a lot of ways. And I think that's what people are feeling. I think right now it's showing up in the compression of our emotional capacity, our ability to focus.
Yeah.
Our ability to be resilient, right? I think we're all feeling the squeeze, even if we didn't have language to identify why we feel that way. I think a lot of people feel it.
I think the thermometer of the moment is the burnout.
Yeah.
Well, you and I were talking last night about our own podcasts and creations and whether we should continue them or not. And our conclusion in the moment was the algorithm wants what the algorithm wants, and you're never going to satisfy it.
Nope.
So that to me is the epitome of the ideology mm-hmm. of both our the society inside and outside of organizations.
Yeah. Well, it creates this effect that you can't ever stop. Right, like we don't feel like we can stop.
That's right. That if we allow computers to dictate that, we can't stop. Enter AI, which is not causing the problem, but exacerbating it to such an extent that we can no longer pretend. And this is where my idea is that we're in a AI crisis, or a company crisis, an organizational crisis, where we are continuing on this same path towards the sort of monomaniacal path of efficiency and productivity. And here enters AI, which can be more efficient and more productive.
Faster.
Faster, longer.
Yep.
And because we've been doing this for 50 years, our only response is to sit and make things go faster, to try to chase that as humans. And what I hope we are realizing, and why this crisis is coming to bear, and why this crisis is actually a good thing, is we can't. We are incapable of trying to out-efficiency-size the machines.
Yeah. Yeah. Colleague said this yesterday, right? We will never robot the way the robot does.
That's right.
We can't.
We've been. So in fact, this is a great way to articulate this, right? That idea of maximize in the title, right? Maximize shareholder value, maximize compute. Like, we were trying to become the machine,
right?
Right. We even say, oh man, you're a machine, right? That's and, right. And, now we have a technology that really can outperform us on those metrics, and people and organizations are breaking.
Yeah.
Or will break very shortly, I believe.
Yeah, I think so. I especially if we try to out-robot the robot, right? Like that, I think that's the move that feels like we need to do it, but we can't. Right, we physically can't, we emotionally can't, we can't keep up. So the move, I think, is to become more authentically human. So what's really interesting about this moment, right, it raises some really interesting inquiries about what does it mean to be human? How do we actually stop being so robotic? I think, you know, to again, like reference back to Tali's talk yesterday at this conference. There's this switching places that we've done. We've become more and more robots over the years. I just love this point that Collie made. We've turned into robots, right? Our work has been roboticized.
Are we surprised that now the excuse, because the frame that we're coming at this with is that we have emulated the robots. Are we surprised then that the excuse, the story is, oh, I can replace workers with AI.
Yeah.
And I think that is the false premise. And now I think we're moving into the second, what I'd like to do is articulate the second half. So we've gone from where we came from to where we are in the moment. And now I'm going to create the inverse of that funnel, right? So it's almost the totality of the shape is an hourglass. So our job now is to understand or think about or imagine ways to create more space.
Yeah, to rebroaden.
Rebroaden. Yeah. And this, I think, will also use the kind of most immediate example is one of the common gripes that I am seeing and hearing personally and on social media is our leaders are giving us AI and saying, I don't know, just experiment with it. And everybody's going, with what time? The organization is a system that has been created to force and reward efficiency. And now we're asking people to experiment, which is the antithesis of efficiency. And that, I think, is where it becomes very evident to the individual and hopefully to the manager and hopefully to the leaders that we are moving in the wrong direction. We're using humans in the wrong way.
Yeah, yeah. When it becomes a very existential question, like so much of our work gets overlapping with our identity. And so when jobs get unbundled into tasks, right? So this is kind of what's happening, right? I think this is actually a more constructive way for people to think about it, right? If we unbundle, like right now your job is a bundle of tasks. It kind of assumes all of those tasks go together. But if we unbundle those tasks, we can start to see more easily that these certain tasks actually are performed better by the robot versus some of these other tasks can never be ostensibly performed by a robot. Like, those are the things that we need to get humans to do. But I think to your point, A, there's not enough kind of slack in the system anymore for people to have any space or bandwidth to actually do any unbundling, because that requires you to step outside of your daily task list and there's that time to do that. But then also it needs really a lot of thought, and it requires a lot of wisdom and intentionality. And these are not things that business is optimized for.
No.
We've optimized kind of all of that slack out of the system.
Yep.
And now we're asking people to do it. And it's like, I think that's where the the tension comes from. I was like, I don't know how to navigate that because I have no...
The system doesn't allow it and I've never practiced it.
Totally.
And to me, the let's look at the kind of an analogy or kind of an opposite antonym analogy or something, where we're seeing AI being used in really interesting to create new interesting productive ideas and executions in other arenas that aren't business. So for example, Project AlphaFold, where we're seeing scientists using AI to invent and create new proteins that could have never been created before. The whole premise of research is that space to experiment. The whole premise of creating a container within a university and having these tenured professors be responsible for doing these research is to create new knowledge. That is the opposite of what business has been doing. But now we're saying, hey, you need to do a completely new thing, and we don't have that space for it.
Right.
So that's the crush of the kind of the black hole of the zero point of where we are.
Yeah. I'm afraid that we're not to the zero point yet, right? This actually gets a lot more crushing before it gets better. But I hope that, yeah, in my happy dreams,
when I have them every once in a while,
when I have those, this is a moment. It's a watershed moment for us to really take a look at what work is and what we want work to be in our lives. Because if we have the option of automating all the crap that we don't want to do, let's freaking do that, right? That, like, there's so much drudgery in work. Like, let's let the robots take it.
I just did an interview about the bullshit work, like defining what the bullshit work is.
Oh my goodness.
Let's do that. But what is left? And this was a question that has come up multiple times at this conference. What is left, right? There's a speaker that said it's an identity crisis. You're like, now what?
Yeah.
And so in your happy place, we have to recognize or really start to create a moment to explore what it is we're trying to expand into. What is possible?
Yeah. Yeah. That's going to be essential. It's why I kind of like obsess over this like optimistic future idea, because I think more of our visions in society right now are dystopian future, right?
Those are of course a picture. Yes.
Plenty of movies. We've got lots of Terminators in our brain. Yeah. We've got like that version of the future is much easier to conjure.
Yeah.
And so the practice, I think, for us to be optimists and say, like, no, what would we actually want? So I borrow a lot from the world of appreciative inquiry.
Okay.
I don't know if we've ever talked about that directly, but the idea in appreciative inquiry is that humans move towards our picture of the future, whatever it may be. And so for us to create a future that we actually want, we need to imagine a better one.
Mm.
Otherwise, we can't move toward it. And so that's why this muscle, I think, is really important for us to work out, which is, I understand, really remarkably hard at this moment when everyone's crushed, like we're all feeling crushed,
panicked by the
pressures.
Yes. Yeah. We're making decisions from a place of fear.
It's remarkably difficult, I think, to be an optimist at this kind of, in this part of the cycle of history.
Yeah.
But I think it's so vitally important, because otherwise we can't actually move towards something better
if we don't know where we're headed.
Right. Right.
So, okay. So this is then, let's spend a few minutes discussing how we might start to create more space. So you're starting with this big concept that, and then you would advise folks to at worst cope with, and at best kind of aspire to a more positive, what it might look like.
Yeah.
Talk to us for a minute or two about what you know about how to imagine an ideal state, a more optimistic future.
Yeah. I think one thing I would recommend is to just understand where we are in the cycle of things, because what's happening right now is very similar to what happened in the Great Depression and the World War II era, right? So pre kind of New Deal, right? We're looking at a world of crisis when government seems incompetent and largely is incompetent, where our social structures don't seem to hold up anymore, where we don't have a sense of social cohesion anymore. That time period was actually remarkably similar to the time period before the Civil War. Also, right there, we've got a period of massive industrialization. Then the technology, very similar to now, right? There's a technology displacement as well right there. It's just steam engines and railroads, you know, where it's AI now, of course. But like, again, a very similar time period. So someone else, another speaker said yesterday that these are not unprecedented times. Very precedented. Look at those seasons of conflict. I think what we see is that we're in another one now.
Yep.
And so if we recognize that, we can say, okay, this is where we are in the cycles of history. And the cool thing about being in a season of crisis is that it can push us to actually innovate. So much of it has to do with our orientation to the conflict, to the crisis. But if we can say, all right, this is what this season is, and it's actually what it's for, right? There needs to be a season of decay and death of the old system for the new thing to be born. Then I think we can actually get some juice from it to the point where we can say, okay, now I can start to imagine a world where I get to work on things that I actually want to work on, or have an economy that I can actually have a say in, or have a government that's actually doing things that matter to me and my family, or right on and on.
In the parlance of innovation, it's a burning platform. We're not going to leave where we are, no matter how it is, unless we've burnt the ships, right? We've burnt the ships and we don't have an option forward. That's what this season is, right? I don't know, I read something, I don't think it's about the terrible 20s. You know, it's like we're in the 2020s and it's like, it is just hit after hit after hit. And I do think that we are in the middle of a decade of this shift and this, like you said, decay or destruction. Okay, so we can imagine this moment as an opportunity for something different. And we talked a lot about, yesterday we talked, there was a conversation about the impossible and embracing the fact that that you don't just shy away from the impossible challenge, because that is really where the richness is. That's what we want. And so here it is, Josh is channeling this permission to embrace an impossible opportunity of seeing that future. Let's get more practical. Inside of an organization, some manager is listening to this now, some leader. Let's just talk through some small, tangible things that we can do inside of our own teams to muscle and create, push back against that system, just at least now until the system collapses. What can we do today?
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about this, Josh. I think it's a really good inquiry. So what comes up for me, and then I want to hear what you think about this.
Yeah.
What comes up for me is a couple things. First, I think we need to protect our energy. I think, right, like through a crisis, you need to be able to keep yourself afloat. Right? So wherever your place is, where you go to replenish yourself, figure out what that is, and then make sure you get it through this time of crisis. And make sure you can do that actually inside your workplace. I think that's the harder part, because a lot of us could say, I can go to the beach, or I can go to the golf course, or I can, but like, you're not actually going to spend most of your life on the beach or the golf course. You're going to probably spend it in your work. So you need to find ways to replenish your energy throughout the day at work.
As a practice.
Yeah. So I think that's a first one. Do you want to add anything to that?
No, that's great.
Next one I would say is, learn to practice restraint, because restraint is the core of wisdom. So no matter what kind of spiritual or philosophical tradition you look at through the history of human culture, if you look at the tradition of wisdom, at the core of it is the idea of restraint. Right? It's what we don't do. It's what I make space for. It's what I stop from happening. That is at the core of the idea of wisdom. And so I would say, this is a skill you can practice. And this is something the machine can never do, right? This is something the robot can never do, is actually restraint, because it's built around the optimization of speed.
That's right.
And so the more we practice saying no, the more we practice our boundaries, the more we practice saying, like, this is the space I need to protect my energy, I think that's another really, really big.
Yeah. One of the lessons that I learned early as an entrepreneur is because business is so unpredictable, you need to be really diligent about feeding yourself and around the other things in life. And so always like just making sure that you prioritize your physical mm-hmm. wellness, right? So whatever your exercise regime is or,
yeah,
you know, always with, and it just need to be really diligent about that. And that lesson is now something that people inside of organizations need to take on, because the organization, and we see all sorts of ways that this is happening, is no longer taking care, like is no longer protecting space.
It won't
it be. Used to be. That was the role of the organization. That was the social contract.
Yep.
You sign up to become an employee, you get health insurance, you get time off, you get security.
Yep.
That's no longer the case. And so as individuals and humans, we need to establish our own practice. And I almost feel like this, there's kind of this sort of millennial Gen Z backlash of saying like, well, the company, like you don't have to take care of the company. The company's no longer taking care of you
mm-hmm.
kind of attitude. And I think that is an expression of that. And so instead of saying, I'm just not going to do my most here, i.e. quiet quitting,
mm-hmm.
turn it into the practice of blocking off your lunch and saying, I cannot make that meeting.
Mm-hmm.
You have to then be your own infrastructure.
Yep. Yep.
That then leads me to, because that we can refill our own cups, but what we know now is community is going to be more important than ever in order to create resilience through this destructive time.
Mm.
So before, what do you do for work? Your work is your identity. You had that community, and you can, I guess my statement is really, how do you find the people that you find energy with,
mm-hmm.
that you can rely on, that could be your team? And as a team leader, you can foster and facilitate that. You can even protect the team from the worst impulses of the organization and the system, and take it on yourself. You need to start as an individual showing up regularly to create some sort of community, because there will be a day, a week, a month, a year where you don't have the internal capacity, no matter how many glasses of water you've drank and how fit you are, to be able to continue to thrive on your own. And we need others. So that might be a spiritual or religious institution, that might be extended family, that might be support groups, that might even just be a regular group, you know, getting together with friends.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's actually very historically precedented too, right? So what we see in these cycles is we come out of a very individualistic kind of time period, and now we're moving back more into a communal focused time period.
We're not in the moment, but looking forward, that's where it's going.
Yeah, like exactly. In the next decade, right? I think we'll see a lot more of what you just said, of people recognizing that they need that.
They do.
Right? We do.
I think we see little snippets of that now, and mm-hmm. and it's couched as a rebellion against social media, right? So the decline of the dating apps, the increase of the in-person events, and that's wonderful. To me, that's a good symbol for that.
Yep.
And I think leaning into those things, and present experience included, this year, one of my commitments was to show up to more places, to conferences that were of, you know, high value, high like integrity. And this, you know, I show up here in Chicago, you show up here in Chicago, we're both from different cities. I'm from Portland, Oregon.
Yep.
Josh is from Denver, Colorado. And we're showing up and having this happy collision. I haven't seen Josh in person in a couple of years. And so now we have this opportunity. So making the effort, putting the energy in, because it is so easy to sit at home, be on your phone, order DoorDash.
Mm.
And we have we need to put in the effort, right? So I'm going to go right back to efficiency.
Yeah.
All of those digital products are created to relieve, quote unquote, pain and effort.
Yeah.
And what we have lost is the most important piece. In the pursuit of efficiency, we've lost the relationship and we've lost our community. And so I think we need to take it on ourselves.
I think so. Yeah.
We can no longer in the moment rely on government. We can't rely on institutions. We can't rely on organizations. And so if you are inside of an organization, you can create that protection. You can create a little bit more space for this.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, it'll be up to the individual to decide, to choose what to leave behind.
Yeah.
What to change. What are you going to change? What practice will you change in order to really survive and prepare to survive the turmoil of this moment and be able to set up to thrive in that next moment?
Yeah, basically, I think what we need you to do is to become more entrepreneurial. Like when I think about a core skill, and sometimes people ask me, like, what am I teaching my kids?
Yeah.
You know, so they're 11 and 13 now. What am I teaching them about? Like, what am I thinking about college or something? I'm like, I'm actually not, because what I think about is how to help them have a strong sense of identity and be able to be entrepreneurial in spirit. So even if you're in an organization, like the things that you're talking about and these things of like self-management of schedule and time and energy replenishment,
boundaries.
Yes. We used to be able to rely on our organizations to give us some of those lines.
Clock in at 9.
Totally.
Clock out at 5.
And I guess what I'm suggesting to any folks who are in organizations is that agreement is also going to get unbundled, right? It's going to get messier. It's going to get more blurry. And so you need to take it on yourself, even inside a company, I think, to be able to self-manage some of those things.
Yeah.
Because otherwise this time period is going to be very difficult without that, without those skills or practices.
So back to the driving force behind this, or at least behind this moment, is AI. And this will be the last little piece that I want to dig into, which is this is undeniably a powerful influence and tool. How might we use AI to support our own this thesis, the entrepreneurial recapture and protection and preparation?
Yeah. I think that's why I like this word and that framing so much, because in entrepreneur circles, the entrepreneur word.
Okay.
Because I think in entrepreneur circles, what you'll hear is that we don't talk about problems. We talk about opportunities.
Yeah. Right.
Constantly reframing.
Yeah.
That's a problem that can be solved with this kind of solution, right? That's the entire entrepreneurial brain, really, in a nutshell. So that's what I'm asking people to do, I think, is to say, yes, this is a problem, but it's also an opportunity. It just depends on which side of it you're looking at.
Yeah.
And I think it's not easy, right? Like any entrepreneur will tell you, we're all a little bit crazy.
Yeah.
Because this is really hard. But it's also, there's a lot of joy in it. And because humans, I think we're designed to be problem solvers. We're so creative and resourceful. It's just that kind of the industrial machine has like stamped that out of you.
Yeah.
If you're
the unbundling of the skills, right? You need to, what can we do? How do we get off this chasing of the highly productive machine? How do we step off of that, right? You only win the race when you stop racing.
Mm.
And so I do think that the challenge is going to be rethink, like, what is your relationship to this? How do you separate from it? Right now we're feeling the pain in our own bodies, but let's extract that.
I think that's right. And I think that's why we talk about things like unbundling jobs into tasks. It feels very helpful to me. Or sometimes I talk about the place your job used to be was kind of in the center, right? It was like making the thing. But now the AI is way faster at making the thing than you or me. And so now your job moves from the center to the edges. And it's more like now your job is telling the machine what to create and then making sure it created the thing that you wanted it to build. Mm. So your job moved from the center to the edges, but it's different tasks. But to your point, if we can start to understand that our job isn't the same kind of cohesive, it's not a cohesive material, right? It's not a bundle of one thing. It's all these other things.
Mm.
I think that liberates us to be able to say, oh yeah, these certain parts are actually more energizing for me.
Yeah.
I should do more of that.
Yeah.
And try to automate the crap I don't want to do. Like, yeah. Let that go. And so that's where I say we're in a really powerful moment. If we can start to shift the conversation from like jobs I have to do to meaningful work that I actually want to do.
Brilliant. Yeah. Josh, amazing. Thank you.
Likewise. This is so fun.
Awesome. Thanks, everybody.
This has been the Hello Tomorrow podcast. If this episode helped you understand more about how the world is evolving, please hit that subscribe or follow button so you don't miss next week's episode. It's totally free and the best way to support this show. And if you're thinking, I wish my organizational leaders were having more deep system level conversations, that's exactly the work I do as a keynote speaker and advisor. Because when leaders have clarity, everything works better. You can find me at joshallan.com, joshallan.com, or reach me anytime at future@hellotomorrowpodcast.com. If you'd like to be an early reader of my upcoming book, Work Will Kill Us All, An Optimist's Guide to the Future, you can sign up at workwillkillusall.com. Thanks for being here. See you next week.